Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is May 24th. I want to start the show today with an article that I found on Psychology Today. While I was doing research for another show, I saw this link and I clicked it. And I'll tell you, I did not really like what I read, but I'm going to share it with you because it relates to our discussion on the show. Title of this piece is called When ADHD Has Nowhere to Hide by Monica Williams, PhD. And then there's a slug here that says, as our society evolves, people with ADHD have an increasingly difficult time. First heading, the ADHD debate. The ongoing debate about whether attention deficit hyperactivity disorder children require drugs or discipline can't be resolved by examining prescribing practices cross-culturally. Dr. Marilyn Wedge asserts that in the U.S., at least 9% of school children have been diagnosed with ADHD and are taking medications for it, whereas in France, it's less than 0.5%. She further goes on to suggest that irregular meals, lack of structure, and weak disciplinary practices are to blame. Next heading, ADHD can be seen very early. As a mother of three ADHD children and a clinical psychologist, I think I can offer a different perspective on this matter. I knew my two eldest sons, born 12 months apart, had ADHD long before they ever got a formal diagnosis. At preschool, my oldest son was once found in the reception office making an escape map with another child. Well, I think you have to admit, Monica, that that is pretty badass. I once pulled into my other son's childcare center to find he had slipped out of the playground and was actually wandering around in the parking lot. At church, when other children were sitting quietly in the pews, drawing, reading their children's Bibles, or holding a stuffed animal, my boys were crawling under the pews. I would grab onto their ankles and pull them back into my sphere of control while they tried to wiggle free. Our pastor advocated regular spankings to bring them to heel, but spanking just wasn't enough. This is somebody writing for Psychology Today in 2013. I read all of the baby books and took several parenting classes, but it wasn't until I really understood ADHD that I realized I never had a fighting chance. My kids were already getting plenty of love, discipline, structure, and healthy foods, but they needed more than that. Even more structure, shorter-term rewards, and a little pharmacological assistance. Next subheading, parents not to blame. ADHD is not just another word for bad parenting. It's an inherited neurological disorder that includes a host of biological issues, including measurable delays in brain development. Children with ADHD have difficulty focusing on all but the most engaging tasks, are easily distracted, and need greater stimulation to maintain attention. There are a number of social forces that have contributed to higher rates of diagnosed ADHD, even if there's been no change over time in the base rates of the biological factors that contribute to the disorder. Increasing demands are made on our children that put kids with ADHD at a massive disadvantage. For example, when I was a kid, we had regular recess times, long lunch breaks, and daily physical education classes. Many schools have done away with these opportunities for antsy kids to release a bit of their energies in favor of more classroom time to prepare for standardized exams. Being expected to sit at a desk for 6 hours can be hard for any kid and torture for one with ADHD. My second son struggled in sixth grade with grades ranging from A's to F's, but this was not from the lack of intelligence nor discipline. Although testing showed exceptional ability, he was simply unable to sit in class all day and then come home and sit for another 2 hours of doing homework. I put him in a Waldorf school for seventh and eighth grade, and there was a dramatic change. With small classes and many hands-on activities like woodshop and needlework, he could keep his mind and body busy at the same time. The kids learned Shakespeare not by reading the book, but by making costumes and performing it on stage. The Waldorf school wasn't a cure for his ADHD, but it does illustrate how a disorder in one context, the public school, could be mitigated in another, hands-on learning. Final heading. This is what really attracted me to this article. Society evolves. The larger issue is that in our society, more jobs require us to sit at a desk or computer for hours at a time. On a farm, a little ADHD might not be a problem when people have acres to roam free and hard labor to keep them busy. But the office people with ADHD are going to have a much tougher time. That being said, I can't fault the schools since they prepare children for this reality. The ADHD kid has nowhere to hide. My son is now a junior at a competitive college. He majors in physics and likes to play chess, blindfolded and sometimes with multiple people at once. He's on the rugby team and starts each day with exercise to help him focus. He wants to be a professor someday, yet his ADHD is not gone. He still struggles to study for classes that he considers boring and forgets to refill his medication for months at a time. After doing a summer internship in biomedical physics, he decided to double major in physics and biology, against my better judgment. Let's just say his grades haven't changed much since the sixth grade. So, how are you going to get into grad school with those grades? I ask. He looks down for a minute and then smiles. I made friends with a physics professor, he says. I met him in my salsa dancing class. The end. Well, folks, I'm not a fan of this woman at all. And this article serves no purpose, from what I can tell, other than to let everybody except the kids off the hook. But anyway, I don't think that requires a tremendous amount of analysis. I just wanted to read it to you because I was so angry when I first read it that I didn't even know what to do. Like I said, it just caught my eye in the other articles column on Psychology Today when I was actually, in preparation for an upcoming show, reading that article that she mentioned critically in the first paragraph, written by Dr. Marilyn Wedge about the comparisons between ADHD in the United States and France. But the way the article was previewed in that column, it said something like, society's evolution creates new challenges for ADHD. Well, for people who are labeled with ADHD. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It certainly does. She didn't touch on them or offer any solutions. Just kind of, you know, saying, oh, well, can't blame the parents or the schools. That's not any kind of a new message, is it? The discussion on the show today is actually about the impact on young people of the, you know, ever-evolving technology with which we live. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm not saying it's something that people need to be concerned about. But there are some preparations that I think people, you know, should look into. And for me, in the early 1990s, high school seemed to be an insufferable experience. I can't imagine what it's like today, juxtaposed against the tiny amount of free time that young people have where they can immerse themselves in this world of games and social networking and other online activities and entertainment. And, you know, this woman is pretty much the mainstream belief on this issue. This article really struck me as just a prime example of what an accidental conspiracy of obedience this whole ADHD thing really is. And this woman is a PhD writing for Psychology Today and parroting a pretty ignorant view of this whole problem. So let's just talk about that other article for a minute. It was written by a woman named Marilyn Wedge, and she has like a blog section like Peter Gray has Freedom to Learn. She has one called Suffer the Children within, you know, the site of Psychology Today. And the piece was contrasting the treatment of ADHD in the United States with France. And the magic words, the magic phrase introduced into the United States psychiatric community regarding ADHD that kicked the door open to all kinds of horrors was chemical imbalance, which basically allows the disorder, whatever you want to call it. I mean, I think there are – these symptoms are real challenges that people have, that I've had and still do have sometimes, that need to be overcome. But the treatment in the psychiatric community in America – is as it's a biological, neurological disorder. Well, in France, they see it as something that exists within a social context. They see it as something that's situational. And their treatment methods are to, wait till you hear this, go after the underlying issues, examine what could be going on in the child's personal life, in their social context, in their environment that might be leading to these symptoms. We could tell from the article that we just read that psychiatry in America is pretty much into pathologizing normal childhood behavior, creativity, and curiosity, basically, right? Poor Monica Williams, PhD, who was so embarrassed by her little children, who couldn't sit still, like all of the other kids, in church. The DSM doesn't consider any underlying causes, any situational or environmental factors. So as the excitement of new technology might, if people aren't properly prepared for it, lead to new challenges for young people, especially in escaping the diagnosis of ADHD, as school becomes even more unbearable by comparison to the outside world, none of that will be considered. If things continue, and believe me, the momentum is for things to continue as they have been for the last two decades with the diagnosis of ADHD and the subsequent treatments. The French psychiatric community developed an alternative in the 1980s to the DSM. I can give you the abbreviation. It's CFTMEA if you want to look it up. It's an abbreviation for something in French. But I really found that interesting because it's talking about it. And I believe that obviously situations, certain social contexts, certain environments can bring out these symptoms. Nutrition as well. The French manual talks about nutrition, something that American psychiatrists are certainly aware of, but it's not the first step in the treatment of those symptoms, unless you can classify swallowing pills under nutrition somehow. I don't think you can. Many of you might have also come across an article recently about Leon Eisenberg, who is the inventor of ADHD. And this quote that came from him in an interview several months before he died, that ADHD is a prime example of a fictitious disease. Well, I saw this on one site that looked a little questionable to me. So I tried to do a little more research. And the story is not, I think, as cut and dry as it has been presented to many of us in the form of memes on Facebook. This originated in a German magazine called Der Spiegel. And there is some questions about the translation. Is he really the father of ADHD? And did he really state as simply as it is suggested that it is a purely fictitious disease? What was lost in translation might be, and I'm just saying might, it's not really, really important for, you know, our purposes here today. I just want to try and clarify this, that by fictitious, what he might have meant is overdiagnosed, over-exaggerated in today's psychiatric community, especially in America. Calling him the father of ADHD is also questionable. What I knew about him before I heard this story was that he was somebody who tried to some extent, revolutionize psychiatry, you know, several decades ago. And psychiatry was very much grounded in the sort of Freudian psychoanalysis, very open to interpretation, and wasn't really grounded in science. And this is a criticism of psychiatry that we often hear, that it's not really firmly grounded in science. So what he decided to do was go out and look for biological evidence, genetic factors, and those magic words, chemical imbalances. So it doesn't mean that it isn't still pseudoscience, but he tried to take that profession and make it more scientific. But one piece on a site called World Public Union is recounting some of the investigation that had been done into Eisenberg and people like him, people in the psychiatric community who ultimately or very quickly were able to benefit from the pharmacological solutions to some of these inventions that appear in the DSM. And I wanted to just share with you one part of this article where they're talking about a study. They're raising the question, you know, how much other than the conspiracy, the accidental conspiracy of obedience, how much of a real conspiracy is actually behind this? And it says, it is an issue that the American psychologist Lisa Cosgrove and others investigated in their study, Financial Ties Between the DSM-4 Panel Members and the Pharmaceutical Industry. They found that of the 170 DSM panel members, 95 or 56% had one or more financial associations with companies in the pharmaceutical industry. 100% of the members on the panels on mood disorders and schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders had financial ties to drug companies. The connections are especially strong in those diagnostic areas where drugs are the first line of treatment for mental disorders. And that is the case with ADHD, at least how it's treated in the United States. In the next edition of Emmanuel, the situation is unchanged. Of the 137 DSM-5 panel members who have posted disclosure statements, 56% have reported industry ties. No improvement over the percent of DSM-4 members. Quote, "The very vocabulary of psychiatry is now defined at all levels by the pharmaceutical industry," says Dr. Erwin Savodnik, an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California in Los Angeles. So in a nutshell, there's a powerful machine seeking more diagnoses of ADHD, ADD, and other disorders like it, where, as the article stated, the first line of treatment is medication. That being said, these are challenging times for young people. So we have the mainstream, very obedient psychiatric professional view that we can disease curiosity, we can disease individuality, creativity. If it doesn't fit the mold of expectations laid down by the schools and the church and, you know, parents with attitudes from the 1950s about authority and discipline. But also, I think kids today have resources at their disposal that allows them to develop some sense of how vast the world actually is. That window didn't exist when I was in school. And I think that increases not only the frustration about the whole experience, but it also serves as a real motivator for a young adventurous person in their quest for novelty, which is very much, I believe, a biological trait of human beings. So hopefully on the show today, we can offer some, not only people a greater awareness of this issue and how the online experience affects that, but also some strategies for how to escape the diagnosis of ADHD or something like it. So let's get to it. This is the live show from May 16th. Heavily, heavily edited. There's probably 40 minutes of outtakes that are available on the website. I hope you enjoy this conversation. I'll come back to add a little information at the end. Hey, everybody. This is Brett, and welcome to the School Sucks Live show. Today is May 16th, and I'm Brett. And in the studio with me tonight, we have Osborne. Hey.
Hello.
And Andre, who's joining us. Can we say that you're from Flaming Freedom? That ended abruptly. That was unprofessional.
Yes, you can say, yes, you can say that.
Are you still doing that?
When I get the time.
Why isn't your picture on the banner?
Oh, that's right. I've got a banner behind me.
On the banner?
I call shenanigans.
Oh, well, because I'm a third guest. I might I'm from Notes for Robots.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask you about, your other website. What can you tell us about Notes for Robots?
Basically, I just wanted a site to post things that are a mix between liberty-oriented and art-related. I'm trying to do a lot of art projects here as part of essentially my activism in New Hampshire, and that's basically a venue for me to post stuff about the art projects I do, and to also kind of put some Austrian economics and liberty-oriented articles in there. The premise is that I have no hope for humanity, and that it's actually going to be robots who figure out how to actually make anarchy work, and so these are notes for robots.
Well, that's
cute. Yes,
that's encouraging. That reminds me, there's a song by, what's that band? The New Zealand folk comedy duo. What are they called? Flight of the Conchords?
Yeah.
They have a song that it's by the robots after, but they've killed the humans. The humans didn't kill themselves. So that's a little bit a darker picture. Than
yeah. I'm expecting our electronic sentient cousins will be far more peaceful than we will be.
Right. Well, that's optimistic. So thank you very much for joining us. And Osborne, thank you for getting us onto Free Talk Live. I wrote about six live reads for Mark.
Oh, are they doing those?
And they are doing them. I was so excited to hear it the other night. So thank you very much for doing that. And hopefully that will lead to some new people discovering the show.
And yay to new people.
Yeah. I also want to continue to move forward our discussion about better learning and better doing. And I came across a video today that I wanted to share the audio of this video with you on the show. This is from lifehacker.com. A very interesting website. Have you guys ever visited?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's searchable. And there's like how to use 20 household objects in ways that you've never thought to make your life easier. And there's bigger, broader psychological and philosophical subjects there as well. This is something that we've touched on in the show in the past. It is titled, How Our Brains Get Addicted to the Internet and How to Avoid It. I think we talked about this, the context was porn before, and the dangers of porn. And,
dangers of porn.
Well, not from
you're,
the,
you're
obviously.
You're talking to a porn producer.
Who's a porn producer?
I am.
What?
Yeah. That's all I'm going to say.
Whoa.
You can't just bring up that topic and then just let it
Give us a little more. And if you're just joining us, this is Andre from Flaming Freedom and NotesForRobots.com.
I don't want to give too much away because we are, me and my partner are doing a niche, and I don't want to discuss too much of the niche until we finally release videos. But basically, as you know, as part of my art project, I'm actually part of this is trying to, I decided to work with my partner on doing pornography to explore how experimental, essentially, I can get with pornography for it to still be pornography and people to get off, but it's also kind of visually very interesting. And there's very much a niche community out there, which is a perfect medium to try this out.
Yeah.
So this niche that you've got that you won't share with us, is it one that already exists in
the porn realm? No, it does not.
Interesting.
Or if it does exist, it doesn't have very much of a presence.
I'm so intrigued.
I mean, more mainstream, what we're talking about is that...
Is it shape-shifting lizards?
Wow. Oh, that's hot.
I didn't... You got me. We wear masks and everything.
Yeah, they go and they control the banks. Well, we won't pry anymore. The way that we were talking about it is that the human brain might not have evolved to the point to be able to handle and process the amount of stimulus that, you know, online porn sites can provide, because you could literally go through some of these sites for hours and hours and hours and hours. And, you know, there's also this novelty that I think, I don't know if it's more specific or more prevalent in men than women, but our biology, I think, is to seek novelty. You know,
well, yes, we biologically have a tendency to be attracted to interesting things, like interesting, and that is under the premise of a novelty. Yeah.
So with a more primitive brain, that doesn't mean we can't upgrade it. It doesn't mean that we can't learn to be better operators of it, our brains. But going into this blind, and this doesn't just apply to porn. I mean, I think Facebook is one of the worst sites of all time for productivity, and MySpace before that, and Imgur, and YouTube, and
well, what they need to do, and this is what people do, is that they create systems specifically engineered to make your searching easier. Mm-hmm. See, maybe you would have more time going off on tangents if literally that 2-minute video we're looking for, you just typed it in and it suddenly appeared, right? I mean, the core. That's why Google is what it is today, because the act of finding information is actually a hard problem to solve, and it's a very important problem, and actually changes the difference of how much productive time you're doing in terms of searching for that piece of information.
But they also, and Google owns YouTube, they also leave this little trail of treats for you, right? Because they're cataloging your search history on YouTube, and the way that the right column on YouTube used to work is that it would be the videos most relevant to what you were searching
right
at that moment. But now what it is, and I don't know if there's a way to adjust this or change this, or YouTube has settings for this, but it's just giving you this buffet of videos based on your search history, not your current search, but things that you've been interested in the past. So almost like it's sucking you into YouTube. I mean, it's genius, but it's distracting.
I mean, we knew this was going to happen. I mean, we've all seen Minority Report, right?
Indeed. So this video deals with the question of how is the internet affecting focus and productivity.
So you're reading an article online when you get an instant message with a link to a funny photo, which of course you have to share. And now you're reading your Facebook news wall, which sends you to a video of a panda bear attacking a kid. And now you're reading Wikipedia to learn everything you can about the violent behavior of panda bears. And this is what 3 minutes on the internet can be like. We live like this all the time, and it has to have some kind of effect on us.
The net is making us more superficial as thinkers.
That is Nicholas Carr. He is the author of The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. To understand this whole thing better, we need to go way back in time to, say, like, the prehistoric age.
You wanted to know everything going on around you, because the more you knew about your surroundings, the less likely you were to get attacked by a predator. And there's even evidence that our brains release some dopamine, pleasure-producing neurotransmitter chemical, to reward us for seeking out and finding new information.
So getting distracted felt good and helped us stay alive. But the problem is that nowadays, predators aren't much of an issue, but we still have the same brains. And also, there's the internet, which is...
It's an incredibly information-rich environment that the net creates for us, and that's why we use it so much. I mean, sounds, pictures, words, text. And what this tends to do is promote a sort of compulsive behavior, in which we're constantly checking our smartphone, constantly glancing at our email inbox. We're kind of living in this perpetual state of distraction and interruption.
Which is dangerous, because...
That mode of thinking crowds out the more contemplative, calmer modes of thinking.
And that focused, calm thinking is actually how we learn. It's a process called memory consolidation.
And that means the transfer of information from our short-term working memory to our long-term memory. And it's through moving information from your working memory to your long-term memory that you create connections between that information and everything else you know.
Kids today are really kind of getting hit from two sides on this. Because school is so boring and mundane and repetitive, I think they're compensating with the little free time that they have by, you know, going home and immersing themselves in the world of gaming or Facebook, and it used to be MySpace, and probably porn, and probably a bunch of other things that people our age aren't into. And it's revving the brain up that to a speed that makes what's going on in the, you know, 19th century model of public school even more unbearable. Well, at the same time, we see this as it happens with any kind of totalitarian structure. Everybody needs to behave a certain way for a sort of collectivistic, top-down controlled model to work right. So when people start, you know, being the nail that sticks up a little, it needs to get hammered down. So we're seeing all these kids now put on these drugs that are having, you know, other detrimental effects emotionally and psychologically. And I think this is often an overlooked factor. And one of the reasons why I wanted to address this on the show is because we've talked about before how things like ADHD or even dyslexia, I mean, dyslexia is obviously, I believe, much more of a real challenge than ADHD, if ADHD is real at all. But these things, from my experience working with young kids for a long time, tend to become crutches. They become excuses for teachers, first of all, excuses for poor performance of schools, and excuses for parents so they don't have to feel as bad about their kids not getting as good of grades as the neighbor's kids do. But they also become a crutch and an excuse for the kid to say, well, you know, I mean, I've heard that so many times. Oh, I have ADHD. I mean, what do you want? Me to sit here and do work? There's butterflies out there. You know, I mean,
there are butterflies out there. I'd rather do that. Go
sure.
Frolicking. Come on.
Right, right. So, I mean, this is certainly a challenging time for young people, and we've always talked about the online experience and the access to technology.
Well, you
and
know,
information.
It's funny. That is also a cultural thing because now these are used as crutches, and it's like it's an excuse to not become better at something. Like, that's why, I don't know if you remember a couple of years ago, the Tiger Mom article that came out in the New York Times, and how, you know, this parent's like, push this very hardcore work ethic into her child.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, there is something to be said about that, you know? And it's like, I mean, I grew up with a work ethic, you know, and the problem is if you're going to have these excuses, let's say you do have ADHD, then it should be the attitudes like, well, you can't do it because you have it. So you need to find a way to overcome it. Right.
Right. And the basically the default position of the very, I would say, liberal world that we live in, and by liberal, I obviously, it's funny, it's actually in its root, it means free. What it means today is the idea that basically the government should control more things because people are idiots and people can't solve problems themselves. People don't know how to educate themselves.
Oh, well, especially when they're not let to. I mean, that's actually the one good thing about the internet is it's kind of like the natural autodidactism of the internet. You know, you get to pursue what you want.
Right. And one of the aims of this show would be to, again, not just become a better operator of the processes that are going on in your own head, but also a better manipulator, a better controller and user of the processes that are going on around you. So if people go into this blindly, like we were talking about with porn, without understanding the chemistry of their brain and the amount of stimulus that they're being exposed to, there can be detrimental effects of that. And I think the same thing is true with the internet generally. So it doesn't mean reduce your time online, change your behavior drastically online. Really, I think one of the best things for better living and better doing and better learning is to just realize what's going on.
But I mean, do we know? I mean, come on. Have there been actual studies on the detrimental effects of being sucked into the internet? I mean, the thing is, there's a lot that the internet offers that real life just doesn't. You know, it's a whole venue to connect with people that you actually can connect with. It's a whole venue to find information that you can't find in the real world. There is such a thing as too much of a good thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, I need to have my everyday walk to get away from my computer screen at work because I'm staring at artificial light for 8 hours a day.
No, I think that balance is very, very important.
Right.
And I could get into working on some project, and I know you're probably the same way, right? Where suddenly you've been sitting there for 8 hours.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're involved in things that are more complex than...
Geez, last week I went like 2 nights without sleeping.
And sat in front of the computer the whole night.
Yeah.
What were you doing? You were trying to...
Statistics.
Did you... did the screen start like flowing? Because if I'm up for that for too long, I've had it where I'm looking at the screen and I'm basically hallucinating and it's like all wavy.
Yeah.
Now, when you're doing this, what's your level? I'm interested. I guess I've never really asked this. Like, I'm interested in other people's level of concentration. Are you able to sit there for 2-3 hours without breaking, without saying, oh, I wonder what's on Facebook?
Once I get on a roll, I don't stop.
There is a zone.
I do plenty of procrastination getting started.
Yeah.
Which...
That's how it is with a lot of engineers too. Is that there's you kind of prep yourself, feel comfortable until you hit this sweet spot of productivity, and then that could last for a couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is one of the things that I mean. I've done a lot of work with kids who were undermotivated in the eyes of the school, and really had to try to give them motivation strategies that could ultimately help them with things that actually matter. Because it sucks when you equate school to work, right? And then work is always something that's going to suck and something that you're always going to dread because that's what they called all of this bullshit that they forced you to do in school.
Right.
So the lack of productivity and the lack of motivation that people learn in school ultimately translates to, you know, people accepting crappy jobs.
Well,
or,
there was that great rant by some random high schooler. Do you see? He was getting kicked out of a class, and while he was getting kicked out, he was essentially telling the teacher is that you have to make the subject matter interesting for anybody to care.
Yeah, I did a show about that. His name is Jeff Bliss. He is the most famous educational reform spokesperson in the world, apparently, from what I've seen online in the last week.
It's a great rant when somebody from his position, his power position, which is student,
yeah,
basically schools, pun intended, the teacher.
Yeah, I might be actually interviewing him tomorrow. We were talking on Facebook, and he said he had to go to Los Angeles, which I'm guessing is for some kind of media thing.
Oh, cool.
Because I want to make sure that he understands the difference between school and education. Like one of his posts, and I mean, he's young. There's a lot of stuff to learn, I'm sure, and I think what he did was great. And I'm really optimistic about his future as a spokesman for these ideas. But there was a post he made recently in a group that he started where he said, "I'm going to school today. What are you doing to improve education?" And I didn't know what he meant by that. But if he thinks school and education are the same thing, I want to, you know, without being overbearing, I want to kind of straighten that out, you know, that they're not the same thing. So I am hoping to talk to him and really, you know, just kind of, how's your week been since this video blew up? What are people saying to you? Like that kind of question. I don't.
That'd be awesome if he becomes famous for telling people that he quit school after talking to Brett Vinat of School Sucks.
That would be pretty epic.
It would be good and bad.
You better prep for that.
It would be good and bad. Yeah. Yeah. There would be some bad. Anyway, we're way off track. Maybe the best way to reset would be to go back to this video, watch a couple more minutes of it. Your calls. Welcome. 843. Join SSP.
So you've got this awesome life-changing piece of information in your short-term memory, but then you hear that email ding and poof, there it goes. That email takes its place and you never get a chance to learn anything, all because of one distraction.
So attention is the key, and if we lose control of our attention or are constantly dividing our attention, then we don't really enjoy that consolidation process.
But I can hear it now. Someone out there is saying, what does learning matter if all the information in the world is just a Google search away? Well,
That is kind of shortchanging our intellects. If that's the way you're using your mind, just kind of searching very quickly and finding information and then forgetting it very quickly, you're never building knowledge. You're simply, you're kind of thinking like a computer.
Which means that our very humanity is at stake. And it would be a shame if we all got assimilated because, well, humanity is pretty neat.
I really believe that if you look at the great monuments of culture, they come from people who are able to pay attention, who control their mind. That's what allows us to think in the highest terms, and think conceptually, think critically, think in some very creative ways.
And it's this kind of thinking that's at risk, being eroded one cute cat video at a time. Don't get us wrong. The internet is good for lots of things, and it should be celebrated. But the best thing we can do for our minds is to find some time every day to unplug, calm down, and focus on one thing at a time. Your email and those cats will be here when you get back.
I can do this for two things. I've realized, like, really get into a zone. It's either for making videos or for doing the podcast. And even the podcast, like I mentioned with the YouTube thing, can be a little distracting sometimes. But I can really, I mean, it's hard when most of what you do, you need to be online.
Which is funny. Where does that medium go on the thing that's apparently that we shouldn't be spending so much time on?
You're trying to suck other people's time.
Yeah.
you're like a vampire.
But that raises an interesting question. When people ask these questions about their motivation or their productivity, I think one of the most important questions that they should ask right up front is, are they doing the thing that they're passionate about doing? Are they doing what they really want to do? Because it's going to be very, very difficult to maintain focus and motivation for, I mean, money only really works for so long. And, you know, I've had jobs that paid well and that was not enough, having benefits. I mean, the people get sucked into jobs and then just stuck there for those reasons. And they become like in all these other areas of life, high school and college, then their dependency shifts to their job and they're just kind of stuck there.
That's true. I've seen that a lot where people are literally dependent on of their job existing. They're not ready for the possibility of that changing.
Yeah.
Right.
So we're talking about dependence, and this relates to this whole online, is it, you know, sabotaging our ability to make meaningful, constructive, useful, long-term memories. Dependence is a big part of that as well. in the schools, this is not being examined in a big picture kind of way, at least from what I can tell. I mean, there might be people who are committed to making the public school system better, but it seems to me that the question is a very isolated one, and it's the same question that has existed for a long time before there even was government school. What's wrong with these kids today? Go ahead.
I find the idea that the internet is what's causing us to not be able to make long-term memories happen fairly laughable when that's how the entire game of school is played.
Right.
You cram this information in your head.
For a test.
Spit it out on a test.
Right.
And then you don't worry about it anymore.
It's true.
Move on to the next thing.
Absolutely. There's this misdirection that people in the schools do. Now, this is different. And I think there is some legitimacy to this because it's not the school saying, the kids can't concentrate because they're on this internet. I think this is the reason why I bring this up is because I think it is a legitimate issue that people need to be aware of. But what schools do, to speak to what you're saying, and that's a very, very good point, because schools like that, but you don't even have the option to have your intrinsic motivation sparked up. In most cases, like you do on the internet.
It sounds like the issue is, and you know, the internet is that the internet is not conducive to building critical thinking, analysis, connections, making connections, those kind of skills.
It seems like what it's saying,
which is fine.
Most importantly, is that the internet is not good for promoting focus, which I agree with. I think the internet is very good at promoting critical thinking skills once somebody is made aware of the fact that anybody in the Web 2.0 world, anybody can contribute to what you see online. There was a time then when it wasn't like that. Today, because there's an understanding of that, like with Wikipedia or something, the intellectual self-defenses should be turned up to a point where people become more information literate and they know, well, is this sourced properly? Yeah, that sounds great. How well is it sourced? Is it biased? Wikipedia even has guides that tell you this.
But that's the part that needs to be taught. That critical thinking aspect.
But it never will be in the schools.
Not in government schools, absolutely not.
Right. So this offers a way for first people to understand a new perspective on why so many kids are being diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, why so many kids are being put on drugs. But also another thing that I really wanted to talk about today is how we can strategize better to live in this world and be more productive and more focused. I want to take a break for a couple minutes and take a look at our chat because I haven't had a chance to do that. This is School Sucks Live, and we will certainly still take your calls at 843-JOIN-SSP, or you can Skype in at School Sucks Live. You can join this conversation, or we'll still take calls about the Carlin Show. We'll be back. Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the School Sucks Live show for May 16th. And if you're just joining us, I'm Brett. I host this every week. Also with me here almost all the time is Osborne there on the left. Man, you know what it is with these bumpers? I'll tell you guys a little behind the scenes story. These are the bumpers that I cut for Ian. And he said, don't worry, I'll do all the fade outs. So,
and now look where you are.
No. But I sent them to Ian for when we were on LRN, and he faded them all out. So I have the originals that have no fade outs.
Well, just consider it as a style choice.
Where the music just cuts off. Like we're
avant-garde.
Yeah.
And also with us tonight, Andre is one of the hosts of Flaming Freedom. He is also the creator of the website notesforrobots.com. Andre, should I call you a porn producer?
You can call me anything you want, baby.
That's kind of been one of the recurring themes on this show because we're talking about some of the distracting qualities of the internet. And I did also want to put into this show, we have two guys who are very, you know, hardworking and successful here with us tonight. So I always do like to get ideas and techniques and tips from people on how they stay motivated and how they stay focused. Some of us are just better than others. I think.
My secret is I don't do anything until the deadline is staring me right in the face.
Adrenaline is a great motivator.
But you
which is why I was up for two nights last week. If I would have started this project 4 months ago when I should have, it wouldn't have been a problem.
Right.
But you also, I felt like you were also talking about the value of starting a project slowly, and eventually you kind of hit a rhythm where you're being really productive. I think you said that, Andre.
Yeah, that happens.
That was Andre.
And
I was more like, I sit and watch porn and play logic puzzles.
For 4 months.
Until the deadline is right in my face, and then I'll start doing the work.
It's funny how we tell ourselves those stories. Like, it doesn't make any sense for me to start this until I've seen everything on xvideos.com. I agree with that, and that's the advice. I don't know if I said this already tonight, but that was the advice that I used to give a lot of kids. Like, yeah, doing this work sucks. So a good technique is to start slowly, right? So work sucks more if you have to do it all at once, right? And you have a deadline hanging over you because it's stressful. It's more fast paced. There's less margin for error. But it can be more fun and more enjoyable if you start something slowly and, you know, mess around with it a little bit. And you're not, you know, like I tell kids, when you get a project and it's due in a month, start effing around with it, you know, right in the first week and explore and have fun. There's more of an opportunity for you to actually have fun doing work, which is a good habit to get into if you start projects that way. So I thought that's kind of what you were saying, Andre.
Were you ever one of those teachers who had intermediary deadlines?
Well, that's like a good idea.
I remember this from various classes where, you know, there'd be a paper due at the end of the semester.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, after the first month, you'd have to have, I don't know, your lit review done. And after the second month, you need to have your thesis statement.
And they're always, but it's also the same thing, right? You wait to the last minute for each step.
Right.
It's true. I didn't really give things like that. We would do like projects that were more creative. I wouldn't have them do a lot of writing.
You mostly just had them do headstands in the corner.
Well, and I did do tests and I regret that. But most of the class was just discussion. Like, I would stand at the front of the room and tell stories, and I would let, you know, kids interject how they wanted to. And we would, it was very Howard Zinni kind of, like those kinds of stories. And I liked it when they would take notes because it showed that they were engaged and they were paying attention. But
that's actually a big thing is, you know, one thing that gets people engaged, if you tell it, you tell stories.
Yeah.
You know, in that format, telling a story is, I mean, human beings love stories.
How do you feel about this for a strategy? Random tests.
It's like pop quiz?
Kind of like pop quiz, except the pop quiz is generally used in the context of what you were supposed to read last night. So it's still the same thing. You're just making sure they cram every day.
Yeah.
Right? I'm thinking more of just randomly during the semester, you give a quiz on something you talked about at the beginning of the semester. Or even further, come at them at a random time the following semester and test them on what they did the previous semester in your class.
No, I never did anything like that. I remember.
Sure, that's actually a pretty good idea.
No one does that, but that's, what do you think about it as an idea of what you could
that's
do
actually
to promote long-term learning?
That's a positive reinforcement mechanism in Skinner box learning. That's actually a tried and true tested positive reinforcement thing.
It's called having a reinforcement schedule.
Yeah.
I'm not a big Skinner fan. And I think part of the problem is that the school model does work to a certain extent, and repetition is very good for learning certain things. It's the question of intrinsic motivation. So what Skinner never factored into any of his equations is this stuff that people have a internal desire to pursue. Will this lead to a positive attitude towards seeking and acquiring new knowledge lifelong?
You have that reinforcement schedule with telling stories to a class, and then I think you got magic.
But the problem that needs to be solved is school is not, or obviously it's not, but it should not necessarily be all about learning, right? It's also about proving that you learned.
Right.
Right.
Very true.
Signaling to the world, I have learned something. therefore I have credibility.
Yeah.
Right? Where the current state of schooling doesn't do that. All it proves is you crammed for
right.
some tests.
You remember
and
on roads.
You were good at playing that game.
Right.
So I think there is a benefit to what you were talking about, Osborne, a minute ago, of kind of, and it's, I don't want to pin it to the Skinnerian model as much, because one thing that I've always told kids is that the reason why when you're five and you try to tie your shoes, it sucks. Maybe four. I don't know what's the shoe tying age average.
Well, it's not six. I can tell you that.
Whenever people learn how to tie their shoes, I had to do the double bow initially, where you do a bow in each hand and then tie the bows together, because I couldn't do the loop. Kids were picking on me.
God, they're retarded.
They called me Double Bow Brett.
Did I hit a nerve? Sorry.
That's okay. It's just when you laughed.
What's the point of that? When, you know, they invented perfectly good Velcro.
That's right. And that was kind of like the Velcro, the suspicion of the Velcro-shoed boy among his classmates. Like, can he not tie? Does he not know how to tie? But Velcro is cool in the 80s.
Yeah.
So,
no, well, anyway. I would own that shit, man. I'd be like, yeah.
Guess
what I didn't do?
That's
waste
right.
2 days of my life learning how to tie my stupid shoes
okay,
for no good reason.
Okay, that's absolutely true.
Using technology or innovation to find ways around things or to do things better or more efficiently. But
I think he's just saying own it. Like if you're, you know, just own your own way. If people
but you
consider
own it,
you weird.
You own it because it makes sense. You know what I mean?
Right.
You don't own it because just to be like...
Right. It's the way I say, like, so what?
It's like, yeah,
what
I smear poo in my face.
Right. There's no benefit, right? And people do that, you know, people definitely do that, right, when they kind of know... This is something that's very common in school. They kind of know that they're the butt of a joke or that they can't escape being picked on. It's very sad. So they kind of, like, join in and feed into it a little bit and accept that role. Or own it in that fake way that you're kind of talking about of, yeah, so what? I like doing this. When the kid, they don't like doing this. I remember happened to me one time when I was a little kid and I couldn't get my hockey skates off. And I was at a hockey camp for kids.
Well, and then you didn't need to take them off.
No, this was so I had to walk, but everybody was leaving the rink and like they were rushing us out of the rink. Right. So I was like, everyone will laugh at me if I'm sitting here trying to take my skates off. Yeah. So I start walking.
Like, look, I'm so hardcore. I just leave them on.
I start walking with my skates on the concrete, and everyone starts laughing at me. And it was a hockey camp, like with a wide age range, and I was probably like 8. So all these high school kids are like, stupid kid, you can't walk on concrete with your skates. You're going to make them dull. And I was like, no, it's okay. I like it. You know? Like it was so, oh, the memory, it's seared into... So painful.
That's I could see how that kind of thing would be seared.
But it's just all these kids who were like this much bigger than me and all padded up being like, you're stupid.
God.
Oh. Back to the tying the shoes. The tying the shoes. I don't know how this will be edited. I might have to just leave this as is. When we first learn to tie our shoes at whatever age we are, when we do that, it's a time consuming process. I'm pretty confident that I could tie my shoes today. I'm not bragging, but I could probably tie my shoes with one hand while I'm driving. Like, probably.
Oh, nice.
And, wow. And I think we all could. I mean, we could
cannot.
I can't imagine it. No.
The reason why, and this is also like when we're little, maybe if we live in a rural area, we walk through the woods. And the first time we walk through the woods, there's a lot of undergrowth, there's sticks we have to move out of the way. But the 20th time we walk through the woods, there's a nice path for us. And I think that...
And a lot of dead bodies.
This is how our brains work. This is very much how long-term memories are made to keep those neural pathways open through repetition. Right?
Right.
So I walk in the woods, I walk out. I walk in the woods, I walk out. I walk in the woods, I walk out.
There's that whole concept of if you do something for 10,000 hours, you'll become an expert on it.
Yeah. And that's that neural system, those synapses just – I'm not a neurologist. If I've never mentioned this before. I am not a neurologist. But those synapses just connect. They fire at each other better.
But this is what I have to say about neurology.
No, but they do. But this – hold on. Let me – I think I have –
No, it's absolutely true. You're reinforcing relationships between neurons to make specific memories and relationships stronger. That's absolutely what you're doing.
I do want to add some science to the show.
Neurologically, the process of consolidation utilizes a phenomenon called long-term potentiation, which allows a synapse to increase in strength as increasing numbers of signals are transmitted between two neurons. Potentiation is the process by which synchronous firing of neurons makes those neurons more inclined to fire together in the future. Long-term potentiation occurs when the same group of neurons fire together so often that they become permanently sensitized to each other. As new experiences accumulate, the brain creates more and more connections and pathways and may rewire itself by rerouting connections and rearranging its organization. One more paragraph. As such, a neuronal pathway or neural network is transversed over and over again, an enduring pattern is engraved, and the neural messages are more likely to flow along such familiar paths of least resistance. For example, if a piece of music is played over and over, the repeated firing of certain cells in a certain order in your brain makes it easier to repeat this firing later on, with the result that the musician becomes better at playing the music and can play it faster with fewer mistakes. So yeah. That's basically the same idea. The paths are made.
Right.
And that is through repetition. So in a sense, Skinner knew what he was talking about when it comes to conditioning.
Don't take it too literally from repetition. I mean, what you're strengthening is a thought. The act of practicing critical thinking also creates stronger relationships between neurons. It's not necessarily memorizing alone that does this. I mean, what causes specific neurons to fire and strengthen is not specifically the act of memorizing.
Or doing. It's doing.
Right.
It's making them
right.
Connect.
Right.
But there was another article on Lifehacker that I just wanted to hit on the bullet points of. We already talked about the first one when it comes to motivation and staying focused. Are you doing what you really want to do? There were a couple others as well, and I did want some input from Andre and Osborne on this or their strategies. One of them is audit your time to see how bad the problem is. Have you ever tried to do anything like this?
What does that mean?
All right, let me read a little bit of it. If you're not sure, can I steer clear of distractions and focus while I work? So the first one, audit your time and see how bad the problem is. If you're not sure where your time is going.
Oh, time it. I see.
The first thing you need to do is figure out whether your distractions are harmless diversions or real time wasters. After all, it's possible that you're working so hard that you're not taking the breaks you need to recharge, and instead your attention is wandering so you can get little relief from your work.
The micro sleeps. What?
But these are those long sessions where there's a question of how long can you function at like optimal productivity or focus for. I can't do it. I really don't think I can do it for more than an hour.
That's it?
Really? Yeah.
I'll tell you, I was going to bring this up earlier. One thing that actually helped quite a bit, and I mean seriously about my productivity essentially doubled or went three times, was when I changed my diet to a paleo diet.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Because before then, and I had to go see a doctor about this, and he had no answers, I had constant energy issues where I just had the lack of motivation or energy to concentrate or work on anything. And when I changed my diet, it literally changed my life, where I've been able to take on and do successfully multiple projects and organize my time much better, rather than after work being tired and just want to watch TV and pass out.
Right.
Diet was a huge, huge game changer in terms of being able to focus and work.
Do you exercise?
I did, but I really don't have the time to. I would say exercising definitely helps with that, but unfortunately, it used to be part of my routine, but it just hasn't been lately.
Yeah, that's something that definitely helps me. And just to speak to what you said about the diet thing, we started doing this thing called Carb Night, mm-hmm. where one night a week to get an insulin spike and then trigger the positive effects of eating the low-carb diet for the rest of the week, we'd kind of binge for like a five-hour window. It's not an all-day thing.
Sure.
I think that's too much. What happened to me was I did my first carb night, and I was just reveling in the Oh, I was eating nachos and then I eat ice cream. And
it can be orgasmic.
I was giggling and just, you know, it was. So then this is with Game of Thrones. I time it for Game of Thrones, right? Because I want to be entertained.
Right.
While I have a smorgasbord of carbs, smorgasbord of carbs. And as soon as Game of Thrones ends, I sit down on the couch and I say, what a carb night. 5 minutes later, I was unconscious. The next day, I felt so lethargic that I started to wonder. I was like, even though I've, you know, been pretty fit for many years, I used to eat a lot of carbs.
Right.
And maybe I could get away with it more when I was younger. But like really since the time, maybe when I became like a 30-year-old man, where you start to realize that you're not, you can't get away. Like drinking will show you this. Mm. Like hangovers are worse.
Right.
When you get to be a certain age. I didn't start doing low carb until I was maybe like 33.
Mm-hmm.
And so a couple of years I've been doing it. And I asked myself, is this how I feel, would feel all the time and just never noticed? It was just the norm. Is this how everybody
right.
feels?
Right. Right. I know. It's yeah. crazy.
I have the same experience. Like I didn't really notice a life-changing shift going to paleo. But if I eat some carbs, I feel like ass.
Yeah, yeah. You know? No, I didn't notice as big of a shift.
Oh,
as
I see. No, it was definitely night and day for me.
And it does help. I mean, it does too. That goes back to that question or that suggestion, really, of balancing things better. I do get locked into these long sessions of sitting in front of the computer and trying to do something, and I realize after a couple hours, whatever productivity or take even enthusiasm I had.
Honestly, I at work I will go outside and take walks, and that time away from the computer actually is a great. That's actually one thing I would recommend for keeping focus and productivity is kind of it's essentially yeah taking that break where you get out of that world and you just have time to kind of like. Collect your thoughts or not even think about it or just kind of like, yeah, taking breaks is actually very important for productivity.
I think it's also good for
people, companies like this is why Google probably gets increased productivity. For example, like I wish companies I worked at had it like is the nap couch. I mean, people would be way more productive if you had a nap couch.
The ping pong table.
Yeah. Yeah. Or stuff like that. Yeah.
I did things to
take your mind off this stuff.
Yeah, I had a ping pong table adjacent to a classroom once for 2 years, and it was a glorious 2 years for teacher and students.
We're going to have nap couches at my office.
I think that's a great idea.
Nap couches are wonderful things.
The other thing, too, just to step away from it, I don't think it's just good for productivity. I think it can also be good, from my experience, for creativity, where you kind of hit a wall with what you're doing if you're trying to like push some kind of creative project forward. But then you get up and you walk away from it and these ideas just start firing after a while.
Talking about neurons, when you're not focusing on something and you're able, your brain is working on other things, you're actually exercising other neuronal connections, right? Which you're opening those up, mm-hmm. which might help when you're opening up those connections, might help solve the problem you're trying to solve with the other stuff.
I used to teach a class at... what was that place called in Hooksett? The Scholars Academy. Mm-hmm. And I called it Secrets of Great Thinkers. And what were some of the strange tricks that people like Einstein would do to, you know, break these plateaus, to break out of these rule ruts, right? This systematized, comfortable thinking that people tend to get stuck in.
Skinny dipping, totally.
Oh, well, have you heard the story of the railroads, the history of the railroad? If people want to ride along the ground, why don't we have some kind of vacuum tube that can shoot a train through it at 500 miles an hour?
Like, no, why?
Well, the story is interesting. The anecdote in the book is this book about Einstein was an interesting one. And what it says is that the reason why we have the railroads that we do, I mean, obviously, as the services become subsidized, so the innovation is stopped dead in its tracks, pun right. intended. And the reason why when the railroads were brought to America, they didn't innovate. They just used the British tooling equipment where they already had railroads there. The British rail tooling machines were built from earlier carriages, right? So the carriages had the same track that the wheel gauge and the wheel base was the same, or the wheel, not the wheel base is the distance between the two wheels. This is the width of the wheels. So was the same for the carriages, the gauge of the actual wheels, the thickness of the wheels was the same. So they were able to use the same equipment that they had been using for carriages. The carriage tooling equipment came to be because those is where the ruts were in the roads, in the old roads around Britain. And those roads were built by the Romans, and they had those ruts in them from Roman chariots that also had the same wheel gauge and the same width distance between the wheels. So you're much like government is a 5,000 or 6,000-year-old technology where you don't have to innovate and you don't have to be creative.
Yes or no? I'd also say, but you also use what you got, right? Path of least resistance.
Okay, that's
that
part of it.
That also applies.
That's part of it, but government is that too. What you've got is force. So the path of least resistance is do what I say or I'll throw you in a cage. If you don't want to go in a cage, no. I'll shoot you.
I don't know. It
sounds
seems
reasonable.
To me like government would be more likely to innovate because they don't have profit and loss calculations. Like, why not just throw away the old tools? Like,
but they do.
I didn't pay for them.
But see, that's the thing. Like, we talk about government like it's one thing when it's really at least two things. There's division of the government, and it's many, many departments and areas and organizations set up to serve the people. It sucks. But then there's a division of government that does mind experiments, that helps central banking, that deals with intelligence. And they're doing what you're saying because they can even take that money that's not theirs and they can take it off the books into these black budgets and they can try to teach goats to talk and, you know, with their minds or whatever. Yeah, yeah. So
they do stupid innovation that no one should rightfully be doing.
But there's a valid question in that. Like, what if this works? What if there just hasn't? And the Nazis were like this too. The
cost
Nazis
benefit did, analysis, dude.
And that a lot of that came,
and that's part of market processes that you wouldn't get.
But a lot of that came from Nazi state science as well. Like,
eugenics is absolutely a valid study, sir.
It's pretty, you know, it's not valid, but it's unfortunately, it's pretty real in history as far as the resources and thought. And
wait,
and,
so what does this have to do with Einstein?
Well, the secret of the great thinker was to break these rule ruts. That's what made me think of the railroad story.
I see.
To break out of these rule ruts, you have to try and think in unconventional ways. So we would play these games where I would be like, here's a problem, here's a tool. Right? How would you do this if you had a screw and a bottle of ketchup?
Right.
You know, and you have to bring those two things together, like across the brain, until you find a way that they can work together. And the mind, you know, another thing that people say, if you're in a creative rut, try writing with your non-dominant hand because it forces your brain to work in a different way.
That's right.
So to promote productivity and creativity, to get out of that routine or out of that seat or that environment that you're in and just walk or do something else can be very helpful. But what this is suggesting is kind of speaks to what we're saying. Grab a notebook and make a note to yourself whenever you catch your attention wandering or after you've realized that you're wasting time and you know you need to get back to work. And I think for me, that happens when you try to stretch a work session too long. Just can't be productive anymore. So balancing things is good. Another one is get the right tools to single task and cut off your distractions. So there must be, I mean, I know there are productivity tools. Do you use anything that?
Not religiously, but I do have some. I have actually on my phone one called Walker. And basically you can divvy up your tasks for particular projects you have and order them in terms of if this is the next one you want to do, if you're delegating to somebody. And it's kind of like a workflow program where you can break down a project into particular tasks and then work on individual tasks and check them off when you're done. So I find that quite useful. I've been using it for a lot of my projects, but I'm not religious with it. Sometimes I forget about it.
Yeah.
I write notes all the time. All the time. Like I just love, that's the one and only reason I love papers is because I love just writing notes.
I found the workflow management systems in the book, Getting Things Done, to be helpful. And you can probably get like a scaled down version of it, like a Cliff's Notes version of the book online. So if people are looking for ways to do things.
I just don't like it because sometimes it ends up happening is that you become too ritualistic with the actual product, what is supposed to help with your productivity. And you know, it's, I don't know. I'm not a fan of like, well, I guess for me, I just don't need it. So I don't need that regiment of like, I am following this app task by task.
Yeah, that was the thing for me too. If a system doesn't have enough flexibility and one thing goes wrong, it's like, well, this whole system is trash.
Right.
Back to Facebook. Yeah, you know, it happens. And that was one of the reasons why I liked the workflow system in getting things done, because it had flexibility. It had different places where different things would go. Once you have an idea of how much time you spend distracted and how much time you spend working, you need to get the right tools for the job to control and manage those distractions. Mm-hmm. Remember, distractions that pull you out of your work zone and keep you from focusing may not just be Facebook or your favorite blog. It could be your coworkers stopping by to chat, or the music someone a few cubes, these people are in cubes, over is playing through their computer speakers. Whatever it is that's keeping you off your game, get the right tools to address it. So we're going to skip distracting coworkers.
So I probably shouldn't have like 100 video games on my work computer.
Right.
That might not be a good thing.
But the problem, I think, for most people has to be the internet, because it's always just a click away.
Yeah.
There's a subheading here. It says distracting website. There are a number of ways to go about limiting your visits to distracting website. We're big fans of Leech Block for Firefox and Stay Focused for Chrome. Both extensions will help you set up your most common distractions and time wasters and then remind you to get back to work when you try to visit them. I worked with a kid, actually. He had a little MacBook, and I wanted to search something. Mm-hmm. And I pulled his computer over and I tried to do a search, and this thing came up and it said, get back to work. He put it on there himself. He was like 12.
Wow.
So if you're a terminal ninja, what's a terminal ninja? Is that someone like a programmer?
Sounds like it.
Or a dying ninja. And want a more arms deep approach, try Get Shit Done, a utility that'll block distracting sites by modifying your computer's host file. There's a section here that deals with distracting applications and, like I said, distracting coworkers. And the other one, the one that we have not covered yet, choose a productivity technique that bolsters your discipline. Even with the right tools in place, it can still be difficult to stay focused. You may catch yourself trading one distraction for another. Procrastination finds a way. Worst case, you spend more time on your productivity system than you do actually being productive. You may need to tweak that system. The best tools complement your productivity method, and the best method complements the way you work. We've discussed some great productivity systems in the past, but whichever one you use, make sure it helps you get more done and isn't a beast you have to wrestle with. And that's what I think we were just addressing about these workflow systems. If you're struggling with your system, it's time to change up and pick another method more suited to you. You only have so much willpower and discipline to go around. Spend it wisely on the things that matter.
Okay, at that point in the show, Andre had to take off, and we wrapped that topic up. But I just wanted to spend a few minutes trying to bulk up the solutions and suggestions portion of the show. And I actually found another article on Lifehacker that I thought was worth sharing. It's called How to Rebuild Your Attention Span and Focus. And some of these suggestions are pretty specific. In fact, this is the author, Clay Johnson, just recounting his own personal experience with, you know, a system that he developed. But it gave me some great food for thought, and I hope it will do the same for you. It is specific to Mac users. But obviously there are alternatives for Linux and Windows for almost all of the things that he talks about. I have to warn you, the first paragraph is kind of cryptic as well. It says, most people who click on this article won't finish reading it. So says Nick Carr. The New York Times will remind you that you'll probably forget it in a few minutes. This idea is so prevalent, even The Onion has started taking jabs. Ah, I see what he did there. There's some truth to it. Many people want the ability to focus more and feel like they're losing the ability to focus on a particular task for long periods of time. We feel like we're losing that ability. Getting Things Done and all the other books out there tend to give you some rituals to cope with the problem, but only if you could stick to them. Most of us, just a few weeks after reading that book, sit next to filing cabinets, virtual or otherwise, and go about our merry way. That's because we're focused on the wrong thing. To get a longer attention span, even a span long enough to read this article, don't worry about managing the information. Worry about managing your attention. Paying attention for long periods of time is a form of endurance athleticism. Like running a marathon, it requires practice and training to get the most out of it. It is as much Twitter's fault that you have a short attention span as it is your closet's fault it doesn't have any running shoes in it. If you want the ability to focus on things for a long period of time, you need attention fitness. Neuroplasticity is how your brain changes its organization over time to deal with new experiences. It involves physical changes inside the brain based on particular tasks the brain is asked to complete. It's why the hippocampus of a seasoned taxi driver in London is larger than average, and how a meditating monk grows gray matter. Your brain isn't a mythological deity, but a physical part of your body that needs to be taken care of just like the rest of your body. And your body responds to two things really well, diet and exercise. Let's presume your brain, being part of the body, also does. Things like inbox zero or cutting down on meetings may be handy tricks, but they don't take neuroplasticity into account. The bet there is that you have a finite amount of attention to spend, and that attention range isn't changeable. That stuff is handy for making the best use of your limited attention span, but it's not going to improve your attention span. It's not going to stop your brain from being easily distracted or unfocused if you've already trained it to be that way. So how do you train to focus? I've been using interval training with great success. Modeled after how I trained to run my first marathon using Jeff Galloway's technique, I practice attention interval training. I got this timer installed on my computer, and I'm going to put a link to this in the show notes because there's lots of clickable links where he explains, you know, like a timer is clickable, so you can click it and you can see what he's talking about, and it either goes to, God, really? Did you hear that? So this is a lot of resources attached to this article through links. I got this timer installed on my computer. It's an excellent interval timer based on a technique called the Pomodoro technique, which has to do with timers mostly outside of online stuff, and that's linkable as well. I'm primarily using it based on its ability to make sounds, set good intervals, and support logging. I started small, 10 minutes of work with 2-minute breaks. My strategy has been to keep it so when the timer goes off that tells me it's time to take a break, I feel like I could keep going. I'm up to 35 minutes now with 2-minute breaks. Interestingly enough, this is about as far as I'll get, probably, while still being able to keep instant messaging on. I found that 35 minutes is the max response time for IM to be useful. The timer isn't the key part, though. It's just a component of a system, like a good watch is part of running a marathon. Here's how I set that up. All right, so then there's several subheadings here that he explains each one of these strategies. First one. I ditched the second monitor. I've been using a second monitor for nearly 10 years, thinking that vast amounts of space were key to productivity. The second monitor myth has been around for quite some time, yet the only actual scientific study I could find linking multiple monitors to productivity was done in 2003 by a monitor manufacturer, a video card manufacturer, and the University of Utah. It's actually a kind of marketing document, not a study. I've opted for one large monitor. Two monitors just allows me to put distractions on one monitor and actual work on the other. Number two, set up Spaces in OS X. Spaces is a virtual desktop software in OS X. I never thought it was useful before ditching the second monitor, but now instead of having always on distraction in one monitor on my desk, I can put my email, Twitter, and surfing browser in one space on OS X and keep it there. When I start my Pomodoro timer, I hop into a space that looks like this, and he gives a screenshot of something that comes from Evernote. Only the tools I need to do whatever task I am up for on the screen. In this case, I need limited web browsing and a text editor to write this blog post. While I'm writing and don't need to use the browser, I tend to blank the screen out so I don't get too distracted by the browser. My third space simply has Remember the Milk running in full screen. Three. Turned the mouse off during work time. During the time I'm working, unless I'm editing, my 35-minute work intervals, I turn my mouse off. I found that I can focus much more on the task at hand if I don't touch or use the mouse. For me, the mouse is a gateway towards passive browsing and web surfing. If I don't have access to it, I can't begin the chain reaction of getting sucked into the web. For me, it'd be like running a marathon on a road with 26.2 miles of chicken wing stores. I might make it a few miles, but around mile 20, I'm going to succumb to temptation. I found that Divi, which is an application, helps me manage windows without the mouse, and that Vimium, another application or program, excuse me, helps me use the web for research without the mouse. 4. Created a proactive routine. Part of my 2-minute break time is used to set up whatever tools I need to accomplish my next task. I use that time to figure out exactly what I need for my next task, close down all the things I don't need for that task, and set up windows appropriately. There's rarely a time when I need more than 2 windows open. My workspace, whether it be writing code or writing blog posts... Oh, get my rifle. My workspace, whether it be writing code or writing blog posts, is more often than not looks like this. And he gives a screenshot of a pretty clean and impressive looking workspace. The setup generally involves closing all tabs in the browser and starting the browser fresh with an about blank page. The key here is I don't just hop into doing work. I spend a minute or two setting up an ideal environment for me to be able to complete whatever my next task is. When I leave my computer for the day, there are no windows open. I start with a blank slate to come back to. No need getting bogged down in yesterday's setup. 5. About those tabs. None of my web browsers, surfing or otherwise, are allowed to have more than 5 tabs per browser window at any time. I do this via No More Tabs Chrome extension. This extension is pretty brutal. If you create a new tab and you're over your tab limit, it defaults to 5, it'll close your oldest one. I've been running this extension for over a month, and not once have I had a serious problem. It forced me to pay attention to a particular web page and finish working with it if I'm going to move on to something else. Love that. Sometimes I have, like, you know, Chrome and Firefox running at the same time, each with, like, and they're separated by project. So I'll do multiple Firefox windows, you know, all related to one thing if I'm working on the website or something. And then if I'm, you know, I'll have one for just effing around and then one for, you know, maybe a show that I have links, you know, relevant links. So that's too many things going on at once, I've learned for me. 6, the environment around me. While I work primarily at home, I'm still prone to distractions from my environment. To conquer that, I have a pair of noise-reducing headphones, and I listen primarily to lyric-free music. Just a bit of noise to keep me focused. I sit at my desk, but I suspect that I'll be converting to a standing desk soon because I don't want to die early. I also tend to keep some snacks, nuts, and beverages around my desk so that food and water don't lower my focus threshold. Though it's a big anomaly here, I'm not working in an office with that many people in it. I don't have a lot of meetings to take. I'm not managing anyone right now. For that, though, I suggest consolidating all meetings into the afternoon and make them back-to-back. That way, you're getting them out of the way and you have solid long blocks of time to focus on getting things done. Synopsis. Like all exercise, different kinds of workouts work differently for different people. For me, interval training works wonders. This blog post, for instance, has taken me 70 minutes to research and write. Ordinarily, a blog post like this before I had this setup would have taken me nearly a full day's worth of work. Most importantly, though, I'm able to do things like read long articles or even academic papers, things I never used to have time for, which really meant had attention for. If you think you're having focus problems, if the concept of Provigil appeals to you, that's a drug that can supposedly keep people up for like 2 days at a time. Or you've thought, oh, if I could only get my hands on some Ritalin, think about setting up an attention fitness regimen for yourself instead. My general advice, 1, do slightly less than you think you're capable of. 2, increase your capacity while staying under that bar, meaning making that short period of time more productive. And 3, you're not going to run the attention fitness equivalent of a marathon today. Start slow. Your brain, like your body, is only a result of what you train it to do. Attention fitness, like any other kind of fitness, takes time even to get into a routine. Once you make it a habit, it starts to pay off. Thanks for listening, everybody. I look forward to your thoughts. I also have to apologize maybe for the sound quality of some portions of this show. I have taken all the acoustic foam off my wall in preparation for moving. So I'm just in a big echoey room. In a week, we'll be, I think, in our best sounding studio ever. I'm really looking forward to that. And, you know, no Rooster. He was particularly rambunctious today, wasn't he? All right. More stuff coming soon. Thanks for listening, everyone. Take care.